Hello everyone, welcome back to another season of Chattering Classes. If you want to be on the show, just send me a message on the Facebooks and I will organize that. Some of you did that last year and I didn't get to you. Ask me again and I'll make sure this year, without a doubt. This is an interview with Duncan Driver and Nick Maniatis, and there's a bonus at the end, which is Duncan and I talking about the Beatles, which is probably a preview of a much larger episode that will happen later on. Enjoy.
I don't know what I'm linking that to. To me, it would mean one or the other, and I'd be waiting
to see.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Exciting.
Me not knowing social cues and names. That's standard.
That's standard.
Yeah.
Not knowing social cues.
Yeah. Yeah, I'd kind of listen to the room and work it out.
How did I miss all this?
I don't know. You don't see me, like, looking to see how when I walk into a room?
No.
Okay.
Go over that again when you walk into a room.
Duncan's going, oh, my God.
No.
What have I got myself into?
Yeah,
when you walk into a room, you're scanning for what exactly?
People's body language, or whether I'm supposed to be standing up or sitting down, or what the conversation is, or how they greet one another.
What to do with your arms when you're talking.
Yeah, if people are swearing or not, all that kind of stuff.
Uh-huh.
Like,
is it so that you can adjust yourself to the dynamic that's already
so
in place?
So I can not stand out.
Okay, well, I think that's actually just you being considerate.
Yeah.
I would say most people do that. You just sound really intense about it.
Or you're more hyper aware of something that might be happening at more of a subconscious
level. I would imagine most people walk into a room and go look around and see what's happening, unless they're like, you know, sociopaths or like drama students at uni that, you know, come in and go, I'm here, which I've seen.
Have you really?
Yeah,
okay. In my experience of the people, it is drama students who do that. I've known some incredibly talented and some very successful actors, but the ones who are right at the top of their game are actually very shy people.
Oh, yeah.
None of them do that.
No.
They're the complete
That's
opposite.
What I mean.
They find any kind of normal social interaction painful.
Yeah.
And then it's like a switch is flipped. When they're on stage, they become this extraordinary creature that's mesmerizing and totally in control and kind of dangerous at the same time. It's very much, in my head at least, maybe it's a little unfair of me, but in my head, it's very much a kind of high school drama student who comes in and, makes a big song and dance
Without
and wants
a doubt.
Everything to be about them.
And tells you, my friends tell me I'm crazy. Look out for me. Like, they're the most boring people in the world. And I've met so many of them. I probably was one at some point. But what you just described there, I would argue that's exactly what you're like as a teacher. So, like, it's awkward, like, the social cues. But do you walk into a classroom and that's like your stage?
Yeah, totally.
And you know,
absolutely.
That's your place?
And I have to start switching on that. Trying to do the nice rapport stuff with kids before you walk in as part of the performance stuff, because otherwise I forget to do it and I start making it about me rather than making them feel welcome.
Okay.
So I kind of have to start it when I leave
day
the
one,
office before I get to the classroom.
Right, you're right.
Between,
it's leaving the office. Is when you have to turn it on, isn't it?
Yep.
That's cool. I'm talking to Nick Maniatis again.
Yes.
And I'm talking to Duncan Driver as well. Hello.
Hello.
We are here, really, I wanted to talk about obsessions, and really is to dig a bit deeper into Nick Maniatis. I don't know how many times you've been on this, seven?
Hasn't been that many, has it?
It's been a few, it really has.
At least four, maybe two major ones, and then I've tacked in on a couple.
I don't know, man. I think you'd be surprised how many you're featuring.
Mm-hmm.
I'll have to update my list and see. But
maybe the person who runs the website for the podcast could
start editing yourself out.
Yeah.
I'll just basically tell you, we're talking about David Foster Wallace, to start off with at least, and this is how I was introduced to David Foster Wallace, author, teacher, etc., etc. If you don't know who he is, then you've got time to look it up. Pause and look him up. But I worked with Nick at school 10 years ago, maybe even more. And maybe just as you were saying, when we were at the desk next to each other, we didn't really communicate very much because we were both like, oh, well, I'm here to do a job and I don't want to say, hey, that's not really going to work for either of us.
Do you like stuff, Nick?
I like stuff, man.
And then I think we were talking about the other day, one of us had a screensaver that was a Mighty Boosh thing. And that just spiraled into madness.
Which one of us had it?
I can't remember. I know Charlie Bobby.
Yeah. I remember the screenshot that it was, but I don't know which one of us had it.
No, and that's the moment we fused into one brain.
Yeah.
From then on, it became this weird thing of, hey, do you like this? Yes. But do you know this side thing? Yes. And this is this thing. Oh, I haven't heard of that. I'll send you that. And then it became even weirder. Like, hey, have you heard this new thing? Actually, I watched it last night. Usually Nick would say, yeah, I watched it last night at 4 o'clock in the morning. And would send me things at crazy hours. I think you were probably up with your first child.
Yes.
Then you're up with Thomas. So you were, gave you an opportunity. And then later when I had kids, it was the same thing. I was able to like, I've just been up watching this crazy thing. My daughter's, I'm sure you did the same thing. Get up with the kid, get them back to sleep. Oh, just stay up for
that's pretty much
4:30 in the morning. You stay up for an extra hour checking things. And then that just spiraled out of control.
It did.
About everything. But he one day, he just gently put a short story on my desk and said, you should read this. It's going to be a bit long-winded, sorry. But it's you should read this story. And I said, okay. And I read it, and it was Forever Overhead.
Yep.
I was waiting for the punchline to be because you'd had a kid. It was incarnations of virtual.
I think we'll get to that. So he gave me that, and I was like, okay. And he said, oh, I'm just, I don't know if he lied, but he said, oh, I'm teaching it or something. So I said, okay. And have you read any of Wallace? I said, no, I don't really, never really heard of him. Just the truth. And sat and read it, and I was like, oh, that was pretty awesome. And then he was like, well, if you like that, then here's good old Neon. I know you for a fact you did use that to teach. So then I read that, and I was like, oh, my God, this is freaking me out. I think it was good old Neon that was like talking about if you're in your head so much, you think everyone knows that you're a fake, that you're just pretending. Yeah. It sounds familiar, doesn't it?
Is it good old Neon that has that phrase, tending to the statue?
I don't know.
I seem to remember it coming from that book. Nick might fact check it. But I seem to remember it being a very, very vivid phrase that came out of good old Neon. The idea that what you, most of your life is devoted to tending to or maintaining the public version of yourself.
Of yourself,
And yeah, that really, really rang true for me.
But I still remember reading that and then standing in the middle of the staff room, freaking out.
Really?
Just completely freaking out. Like, this man has seen my brain. Again, it was like what I was talking about with the Beatles songs where you tend to think about how it relates to you. But that was the first time where I was like, he just kept going. So it wasn't like, oh, you are presenting this person to the world that's not real. He just kept going deeper and deeper, and each layer he went into it got more and more claustrophobic and horrible. So then I said, yes, that was great. Well done. And then, I don't know, maybe you gave me a supposedly fun thing on lobster, all this stuff like that. And then I think I was over at your house and was like, cool, I'm really enjoying all of these. And then I was like, what's that big one? And you're like, oh, that's Infinite Jest. And then you gave me that copy. And you're like, here you go. And it's 1,000 pages and it's super dense. Mm. And then I think it was about that stage where you were like, oh, I run like this little website about David Foster Wallace. And I was like, okay, cool. That sounds great. And then I went online and found it. And I was like, all right. And then put an alert on it. And then it kept popping up in all over the world. And this article is from this website. And blah, 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 and Nick Maniatis. Like, and I was like, what is going on? And then I looked for other David Foster Wallace websites, and there weren't any. Everyone had sort of like, no, this guy's doing the best one. This is the one. In the world. So, my question to you is, how do you walk around with that?
What do you mean?
Well, the fact that you were certainly went at that point right into David Foster Wallace.
Yes, yeah.
And you've got this site, which is the site. I mean, you can contradict me, please.
I wish it was still now. It's not quite now.
No, it's not now, but this is
but this
at
is,
the time.
This is, yeah,
2007,
it was. For a long period of time.
It was, yeah.
The site that people went to get all their Wallace information. Mm. Like, number one, how did that start? And I don't want, like, not your obsession with Wallace, but how did the website start? Yeah. And more importantly, what was the point where you were, was there a point where you freaked out that it was getting not huge numbers of people, but it was certain people close to Wallace especially?
Oh, absolutely. Yes, that's probably why I didn't tell you, because it was already kind of embarrassingly big.
Right.
In my head, and clearly, I know I'm in company that will probably like agree with me, but that whole thing is, if you feel you're getting too famous or too well known or whatever, that kind of a bit of a fraud around it.
Yeah.
That maybe I don't deserve it or what have you.
Yeah.
But I mean, it started just because of loving Wallace and loving the web. And I've always had obsessions.
So when did you first start tinkering with the web? Even before Wallace. What year? Because that's always a good
starting point. 1996-ish. Mm-hmm. Like, I was in university, and I remember being at uni with a friend, Chris, between classes, and is the AD Hope is the main library at the ANU?
Mm-hmm.
And suddenly there was a lab of computers that I hadn't seen before. I don't know if they just appeared or if I explored a new bit.
Yeah.
And they were all, it was NCSA Mosaic was the browser, and Yahoo was a link there, and Yahoo was just thousands of links out in alphabetical order.
Yeah.
And I remember going, S, Simpsons.
Yeah.
Oh!
Wow,
it's all these Simpsons. And it was just Simpsons quotes. Yeah. You know, it wasn't even that, there weren't even any images. It's like, has this got a list of all the Troy McClure episodes that exist? Like, you know, up to that. So that kind of, wow, what is this?
Yeah.
And I don't know the time frame. It's too long ago. GeoCities were a free web hosting company that had advertising banners, and you could sign up for free and run a free website. And so I started my own little website, links and things that Nick likes, and I had like links to The Cure and probably that Simpsons page and other things. And that page is long gone and hasn't existed. Like, I remember looking for it once and I couldn't find it. And then it was, you know, I'd started reading Wallace, and so I was looking for links, and I was just putting, because, you know, everybody just linked to other things, and it sort of quickly became apparent that there was somebody else who was doing a whole list of links about Infinite Jest, which I'm not sure if I was probably reading at that stage, and there was another website that was the David Foster Wallace website that had a few links to different reviews and bits and pieces, and there might have been one other little thing, and I'm just competitive as well, maybe not publicly but privately, so I wanted to have more links, and then it so that's it. It was really, I like stuff, I get obsessed with things easily. This is a great way to put my obsession in a spot where only I can see it. Well, my family and friends aren't affected directly, but and have no idea of the connectivity of the internet, no idea how many people were looking or anything like that. So that's how it started. It was just a collection of links.
And what year about did you realize it was?
That I don't know. Maybe it started to mean something when one of the other Wallace sites just stopped updating. It was probably when people started emailing. If I didn't see news or an item, then I'd get told about it.
Yeah.
which that was kind of exciting. And that was before you could set up Google Alerts to get advised of news.
Yeah.
So it was sort of reliant on that. And people from the Wallace L mailing list would email me off list and say, have you noticed this? So then there might have been something posted to the list, but if I'd have missed it or whatever. But, so that was... It still always felt like not very many people, though. It still felt like, particularly in Australia, who's Dofos Wallace have to explain every single time. Nobody read anything, so then you have to give them something. And would not have to, but I would.
Yeah.
And so, whereas in the United States, well and truly known as...
So why, and maybe Duncan, you have an idea on this too, why was he not as well known, not as well known, but why wasn't he well known in Australia?
Oh, that's a tricky question. I suppose there is an element to his work which is, which some might consider to be off-putting. And it has something to do maybe with the length and intellectual dynamism of it, maybe.
Yeah.
But it's not just that. It's it's that it's intentionally challenging.
Yeah, I was just about to say, he's probably the first author that I read, number one, that was like obviously setting up a challenge for the reader. And he also did it in a different way that didn't come across as condescending or... what's the word I'm looking for? Where he was like, behind the basis behind it wasn't, I'm better than you, or I'm deliberately making this obtuse or making it hard to see because I hate the reader. You know, I've read books where you're like, why? It seemed like you're hostile. There's no hostility.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of very difficult literature which seems to be born from a place of somebody writing purely for themselves.
Yes.
I tend to think of maybe late James Joyce work like that, like Finnegan's Wake.
Yeah.
If you imagine the writer as a kind of somebody's invited you into their home, then James Joyce is the guy who's forgotten you were arriving and is off in a shed in the back doing something else.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, the moment you publish something, there is some sort of contract between you and this person, some sense of value for money, some sense that you should be writing with some imaginary reader in mind.
Yeah.
And it's hard to think of somebody other than Wallace who is able to write something that is incredibly dense and difficult and challenging and scary, but also is so clearly written with a readership in mind and with a genuine desire to give something, to give the reader something of value. It's a very, very hard tightrope walk, and he manages to do it.
And it's a hard sell on... I found it really tough as not particularly loving Australian literature and finding it very challenging, and finding a lot of the stuff that we were made to read, there's a lot of identification with Australia as the outback and that kind of stuff, which I get. I totally get. But it's not me at all.
And I think we spoke the other day, the other version is this 1970s version of like a real class battle going on, which never connected with me. And maybe because being painfully middle class, I was unaware of that completely. But it was, I'm the same. I find a lot of Australian literature is always like distant.
I feel exactly the same way. And I don't know about either of you, but I've always felt a weird kind of guilt about not being able to connect to my own country's culture. I mean, those who are listening to the podcast probably don't think I sound particularly Australian. And I'm continually asked whether I'm English.
Yeah.
And I have been there a number of times, not long enough to justify the way that I speak. All I can say is that it's not intentional. I'm not trying to put on airs and graces and sound like I'm from somewhere else. But I do.
But that's still an inbuilt thing of if you're from England, you are superior.
Mm.
And we never admit that, and we, you know, we've moved on from so much of that, but it's still the same. And that's what people are wondering is your accent.
Mm.
You're not putting on airs. Why is a British accent putting on airs? Like, why?
Yeah,
why
I think if I made a very conscious effort to sound Australian, then I would be putting some kind of air or grace. Yeah.
Yeah. I went through a huge phase of loving Peter Carey.
Yep, me too.
What a surprise. and almost obsessively so. And then suddenly I hit a brick wall with something and I just stopped.
Mm.
And Janie has given me, I think, two more Peter Carey novels. And I was buying everything. And I kind of hadn't realised I'd reached this point that I couldn't read any more of his stuff. So I've got unread novels at home, and I don't know if I want to go back to them.
Yeah.
But there's something in his stuff that that was before I'd read DeLillo and Pynchon and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And then I was drawn to those. Yeah. I was drawn to those worlds.
Yeah, I got into like magic realism through Tim Winton, through Cloud Street.
Yeah.
I haven't liked any book he's written since in any way, shape, or form. They tend to make me angry, unreasonably, as always. But Cloud Street was that book where I was like, this is more Australian than anything I've read. It's magic realism. I like this genre. What else is there? I asked my lecturer at uni. He was like, it's, you know, Gabriel Garcia Marquez. And I spent 10 years reading that book, his books, trying to get started and get into that world. But that was like the first time where I was like, oh, Australian literature. I read a lot of Peter Carey at uni as well, but most of it I didn't get. But why would, do you think challenging text, you just wouldn't have been attempted to like publish in Australia? Like, I still don't understand why. And as I was saying to you earlier, Duncan, like, my mother-in-law loves going on cruises, so every time she talks about it, she's saying the exact same thing Wallace says on Supposedly Fun Thing I'll Never Do Again, where he talks about how painful cruise ship travel is. Mm. Having every need catered for you is bad for you. And my parents-in-law tell me the exact same things he says, but they're saying how great it is.
Spinning it as a positive.
Yeah, yeah. And I said to Justine, oh, you need to read this, just read this one.
Mm.
And I forgot how funny he is. It's not like some of his work is really challenging, but consider The Lobster is, again, really, I've never been to these places. I've never been to a lobster fair, but I'm really interested in lobsters after reading this work. It's funny, it's interesting, and it's not challenging in that way.
Mm.
But so it challenges you. Your opinions about things very, very carefully.
Mm.
Yeah. But why would you not, why would that be unsuccessful in Australia or not known? But I don't know, maybe the market's too small.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not really answering your question, but it's what you've been saying has led me to think about the fact that pre-2008, the main reaction I had from reading Wallace was that this guy was a humorist.
David Sedaris style, right?
It had strong strains of melancholy and sadness in it and depth, but in the same way that maybe Shakespeare or Dickens or Jane Austen does, who I also think of as essentially comic writers.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like one of the sad effects of Wallace's death is that a lot of the humour that seemed to be so front and centre has now sort of gone quietly away in so much of the writing, and it's much, much harder to see that as the main thing in it.
And I have been thinking about your question, and I was trying to think if I'd changed my degree from straight science to science arts and English literature and other stuff at that stage. I think I had. And so I was in the background quietly reading Wallace while studying lit, and then I did a modern American fiction unit, and you know, I'm Crying of Lot 49 was in that. I think there's some DeLillo short stories, and there's all kinds of like interesting stuff, but I think there was a big thing. David Foster Wallace is a postmodern author, which he, right, he would probably reject, yeah, but he's totally influenced by that whole movement and mm-hmm, what etc. and uses those techniques and tools to whatever. But there was kind of a bit of an embarrassment to say that you liked postmodern fiction at ANU when I was studying there. So wow, there was also this part of, oh, well, you, it felt to me that more senior students and lecturers were kind of saying, well, you know, that's the in thing right now to be into that. And you're early 20s, white male, identifying with the movement that's targeted just to him, right? And so this is, I think, the first times I've articulated this kind of stuff, but there was kind of an embarrassment. So, but I could be a huge fan and do stuff online and be kind of secret.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, wow. It's, I think what you were saying before about the fact that he committed suicide in 2008, literally, you know, a month after I'd finished reading Infinite Jest, but it's the same, I feel the exact same way, is that after his death, that's how people deconstruct his work.
Oh, absolutely.
Or they look for clues, you know, and that's what happens. It happens in any field, especially of art. If someone commits suicide, you know, let's go through all his work and find, oh, this bit was particularly, so we missed that sign. And you're like you said, you're discounting all the life of him. You know, you're looking at his death, but his writing is so full of life.
Yeah. And I think it's also the case that there's a bit of a popular fallacy that that gets supported by biopic films.
Yeah.
That the circumstances of the life explain and produce the work.
Yeah.
And I mean, I'm not a creative genius, so it's very hard for me to say with any authority. But those who have spoken and have been at pains to explain elements of the creative process, generally say the life is a kind of an adjunct to the work, and the work is a mysterious and creative thing that obviously bears a relationship to the life, but the two don't fit together in this sort of neatly packaged way that a film like The End of the Tour or a film like Becoming Jane would lead you to believe.
Yeah.
It's not nearly as simple as this thing happens and therefore it leads to this novel.
Therefore I did this work.
Yeah,
and I think that's the, especially in your younger, when you're younger, there's a that's why there's a romantic element to, you know, tragic figures. There's a romantic element to artistic figures who have had like horrible lives, or are drunk, destitute poets, because that's how you get the best stuff. It's clearly not true.
Yeah, it's not true at all. And you only have to look at the circumstances of Wallace's life to realize that.
Yeah,
because in periods of serious mental illness, he was not able to write anything.
No, that's right.
So it's ridiculous to think that somebody who is suffering serious depression could sit down and write The Depressed Person, because you don't have that kind of creative energy.
Yeah.
You
yeah.
do that when you're actually feeling well.
Yeah, and I think any kind of deconstruction of any text loses any kind of authority as soon as it leads to that kind of speculation. As soon as they go, well, you know, he had this and this is why he wrote this, because, you know, I reckon it's because of this happening in his childhood. I mean, there are links you can make to his early life, to like Infinite Jest, the character Infinite Jest, but he's made those links himself as well. But anytime, I especially post 2008, so much of it is just, oh, well, that sounds right. And I always hate that, where people explain things to, well, like you said, A plus B equals C, when talking about a life, doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, slight segue, but I like the way Mark Lewison points out that in reference to the Beatles too. He says, you know, a popular historian or a journalistic view will look at their career and they'll say, okay, well, this is the Revolver period and it goes up to this date in 66 and then they enter the Sergeant Pepper period.
Right, yeah.
And you forget that that's not how these four people actually live their lives. They're not thinking in terms of these discrete segmented sections of time.
Yeah, and you look at, oh, the fashion, this is what they look like, and even to the point of when they made that album, they were on this drug,
exactly.
And when they did Sgt. Pepper's, they were on this drug. And when they did the White Album, John had progressed to cocaine and heroin. Like, it's like, how does that tie into anything? Like, yeah. They went, you know, we've made that album on that drug.
Mm.
I need to change drugs to make a different album. It's really
it's
weird,
silly to think
it?
Of it that way, isn't it?
Yeah. But that's true, and I will say we will probably bounce around to Beatles stuff
that's
as well.
Fine.
We're doing Obsession.
I've got some answers for you.
Okay.
I'm glad that having three people is good. I can sit and
think. Yeah.
When I started receiving advanced release copies of books, that was
like unasked for. You just they were.
was hang on. I mean. Hi, Nick, we'd like to send you a book. I mean, you know, even at that stage, you know how the world works.
Yeah.
They're sending it to me so that I'll read it and promote it and say, read this. But of course, when you actually love it so much and you're not doing it for money, it's the best thing ever.
Yeah.
Of
course.
So that was one thing.
When was the first time, can you remember?
Unsolicited. I'd asked for a couple of little things. I know when the Understanding David Foster Wallace thing came out, I got sent a copy, which was nice, and but I did receive an advance release of Oblivion. I have two of those, I think, which is nice because I like them. They're nice as well, as in advance releasings are really lovely. You can tell they knew they were posting in a chest, that kind of stuff. And then loving Oblivion so much, no, very little humour in that. Actually there is, but. It's in that kind of
Yeah,
that's right. so that was kind of one stage of it, which was a lovely stage. Another was when I got emails from legal services asking me not to link to things.
Right,
so you kind of know you're big when
you're noticed.
When you're noticed in a way that the people involved with the publication of stuff don't want you linking to this stuff. But I can't remember exactly when that was.
Yeah.
My memory from when we go into like blocks of 8 years ago, it's terrible.
Yeah.
But that was, I found it really disturbing. I found that really distressing.
Okay.
It's very interesting to read right now in the news, Boing Boing website and the Electronic Frontier Foundation. There's some legal stuff about them linking to a document or a web page that had every single Playboy centerfold, and they wrote an article saying, isn't this interesting looking at the way gaze and beauty has changed over time? So they got hit with the thing saying, can you take down the link to that? And they're like, it's a link, but we don't own that material, we're not pretending to.
Yeah.
And this is only this year recently in the news. I remember thinking, and I remember writing an email back politely saying, that material's not on my site. My understanding that's linking isn't illegal.
Yeah.
Of course, I'm not going to pay for lawyers or anything, so I took it down, and it was scary. Yeah. But in the back of my mind, I'm like, if we police the internet like that, then we'd have no internet.
No.
You could do that for any link, and that's kind of the basis of how it works. So that was one side. And as much as that was horrible at the time, I got to know some people through that. That became very productive, positive relationships. So that was, and the best one, not going into the suicide stuff, was in the late 90s and early 2000s. One of my favourite bands, artists, were Biff Tech.
Yeah.
So Kate Crawford, who now works at the AI Now Institute in the US. I'm sorry, Kate, I can't remember exactly what your role is there. And Nicole Skeltes, they together this Australian Electronic Act. And incredible. And something that Janie and I bonded over and loved their music together.
We played that on the very first episode of this podcast.
Yes, and in fact, it would have been the song that Janie and I, that was one of the songs that we like got together and realised we like this music.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I was always on their website checking for new releases and stuff. And then one day in their links to sites they liked was the link to the Howling Phantoids because they loved David Foster Wallace. And my world exploded. Like my head just went.
Yeah, wow.
My favorite music right now, they're linking to my website.
Yeah.
What? and so that was pretty cool.
That was pretty cool.
And then being able to sit on a panel with Kate Crawford and some other lovely people at the City Writers Festival post Wallace's death, mm-hmm. and to, you know, to spend time with them and kind of meet people who you were a fan of, and then find out that they're an awesome person too.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes they're not.
No.
And so to meet lovely people as a result of that, that was, yeah, and that was clearly my 15 minutes of fame moment was being, you know, at the Writers' Festival as a guest type thing, speaking about Wallace. It was just.
And you never had any direct contact with Wallace, did you?
No.
But I gather from things that you said to me in the past that you have an inkling, at least, that he was aware that your site existed.
Yes, he was. Yeah. And I also knew that he would have written to me if I'd written to him. And that he did for everybody.
Okay.
That was
so
what he did.
You didn't want to do that?
I didn't want to put him in the position of feeling that he had to, because, you know, from some of it was clear, and when, you know, I guess it's come out subsequently, that when that was interacting with the fans was important, but also taxing.
Mm-hmm.
And who he was and the persona he projected and who he wanted people to see who he was, that mm-hmm. was an effort.
Yeah.
And so I kind of knew enough of that never to do it.
Mm.
And of course, when he died, I was really sad that I never sent anything, at least to say thank you. But I also hope that in trying to keep the website mostly about his work and not him, that kind of showed that I was more interested in the work than in the person. And that was always an important distinction that I maintained, of course, until he died. And then that's where that stuff started to slip.
Because
it's just too
hard. It's impossible to do it any other way.
Yeah, wow. Yeah, that is an important, like, delineation, isn't it?
Mm. And then the website crashing after he died. After having so many hits. I went over my bandwidth so much. It was ridiculous. And the number of hits were just... It just was out of this world. That was like, oh, okay, people are coming here. Right. And because I just maintained a page of links. I couldn't speak. And so all I did was collect every single link and memoriam and memory and put them all in one big list, and it just got hammered.
Have you ever written anything like that?
I've written a couple of small things on kind of anniversaries of.
Yeah.
But I know that there's also, you know, I can imagine for family, it's really hard that the internet community and the world literary community, they celebrate, remember on such a sad day.
Yeah.
And so in recent years, I might post a link to something that I've written or post a dot, as is, you know, the online thing of a, you know, that. But, yeah, but I did write some things early on.
Okay.
And so... Yeah, you can...
They're there.
Yeah, they're there.
Okay, this is the next thing I wanted to get to. We're all teachers.
Mm.
When I first started teaching, one of the first year I was teaching, I don't know who it was, they said to me, the thing you should never do as an English teacher is teach something you're passionate about.
I don't know. I think if you pick the right things...
Yeah.
And you go about them in the right way,
yes.
then it can be very rewarding. I think it's just as bad to teach something that you have zero interest in.
Yeah.
But yeah, there is something to be said for you bringing this sort of precious thing into mm-hmm. a class and wanting to share it and feeling like it gets destroyed, or you're casting pearls before swine or something like that. And you can end up really resenting the experience.
Yeah.
That
yeah.
can happen.
Well,
that's true.
Yeah, they said you will affect the...
Who's they?
Oh, this teacher, I remember. I don't know who it was.
Though. Wow.
And they said it can affect... You'll go in and go, this is great. And I go, this sucks. This is boring. And you'll be like, okay, number one, I don't like it. You said you resent the class. And then you'll go home and you'll put on that piece of music and you'll watch them and their voice is saying, that's crap. Will be in your head. I haven't found that to be the case.
I haven't found the case at all.
Like, I'm glad I didn't take that
twice,
advice.
Once or twice I did experience that. There's a, I think it's a Russell T. Davies two-part TV thing called The Second Coming, which is about exactly what the title says.
Yeah, with who's the lead in it?
Christopher
Eccleston.
Christopher Eccleston.
That is an incredible scene.
Absolutely love it.
Have you seen it?
No. It's a wonderful
watch it.
Two-part.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I had a class that were interested in high concept sci-fi and things that had a religious or philosophical nature, and so I was really excited to show this.
Yeah.
And I absolutely hated it, and so I got really shitty in the class, and it was one of those days for me.
Oh,
but most
wow.
of the time, I've experienced the opposite.
Yeah,
I found that my infectious enthusiasm does have that infectious effect.
But also thinking back, if I was smart enough, and I clearly wasn't, I would have said, but surely if you're mature enough, you can handle people cheating on you on things you love, right?
Yeah.
That's, as a, 22-year-old, there's no way I could have survived anyone saying, no, that's not as good as you think it is. That would have, that's terrible, right? And I'll throw it out. But to not bring anything, isn't that, I don't know, the older I get, the more I think about it, the more ridiculous that statement was. Or don't have too much passion. When you're a teacher, don't bring stuff you love into the classroom. Just keep it on a level playing field, I guess.
That's the basis of my teaching. Like one of them.
Yeah.
Or pretending I love something.
Oh, without the pretending. That's a really good point. How much of your job is pretending to like or to be enthused about what you're teaching?
A lot at the moment.
Yeah. So you're at university.
Yes, I'm now working at a university and...
And do you teach people ostensibly how to be teachers? Is that
Well, I don't know that I can. I don't know. I can teach people how
That's
to
what
teach.
I wanted to.
All I can do is
that what your boss
look at
wants
elements
you to do
of theory.
Yeah.
I can talk about what's worked for me. I can talk about things that definitely haven't worked for me. But I'm also, I'm at pains to point out that things that don't work for me have clearly worked for other people.
Yes. Yes.
People I know. And so it is very, very difficult. But
do they sit there and think, well, why are we here instead of being in the classroom?
A lot of them probably do, to be honest. But look, I think when either the students or people I know who are teachers trot out a line like, well, all of this ivory tower theory is all well and good, but when you're actually there in the class, that's when you know how to teach.
Yeah.
Okay, fine. But I want to respond, do you want that to be the case? Do you want there to be this big difference between the two?
Yeah.
And, they're not going to say yes to that.
No.
I say, well, then aren't you kind of perpetuating that problem
Absolutely.
By emphasizing
yeah.
that
yeah.
that's what exists?
Because yeah.
that's not what I'm trying to do. I tend to think that any good teacher reflects on what they're doing in the classroom.
Yeah.
And if you leave a class and think, that went awful, that was horrible, I wonder why that didn't go as I'd planned.
Yeah.
Then you are theorizing. And similarly, if you walk out and go, that went really well and I have no idea why, and then you start sort of unpicking it, that's all I really try and do when it comes to analyzing what works or doesn't in the classroom.
I think that is the biggest discrepancy between not a good and bad teacher, but a successful and unsuccessful teacher, is the attitude when you come out of those classes, especially if they don't work. But I think for both, if you come out of a classroom and you don't think that was great, why, or that sucked, why, which some people don't, they go yay or boo to that class, like that class was great today, or they suck, and then they don't think about it anymore. That's, I think, the biggest difference between teachers who are successful and not, is just going... Because usually, if you have a really shitty class, your first thought when you come out is, I hate that class. They suck.
It's their fault.
But you have to sit in it a while. You have to sit in your rage for a while.
Yeah, that's right.
It's healthy, process it.
You've got to stew a little bit.
Yeah, and go and complain to other people. But you have to go, well, what did I do wrong? And it's always you. It's always something that you didn't see. It's always... Well, when we came into class, I knew that kid was elevated and I just went, not today, I couldn't be bothered. And then all of a sudden, that's what happened.
Yeah.
So there's all that stuff that goes on, only improves if you think about it later.
Yeah.
And I don't know how much of that happens or how much time are we given in the job to take a little time to think about what happened today and what you can do to improve.
Well, another thing that I tend to say a lot is that when you go into schools and become teachers, you're going to find that 99% of your time is taken up with urgent concerns. Yes. Like this kid has opened a window and crawled out onto the ledge, or you know, there's an assembly in the next 5 minutes, or whatever it is.
Yeah.
And these urgent things have a way of getting in the way of stuff that might actually be much more important. And you have
nodding vehemently.
You have precious little time to actually think and focus on the important. So don't you want these 3 or 4 years at university to be devoted to that important stuff, so you can at least have spent this time thinking about what kind of teacher you want to be, or what you value or what you don't value?
Yeah, that's really good. I'm going to have to rethink what I tell people. And I say to them, you don't learn anything at university and you only learn in the classroom. Because I think I said that exact phrase to you the other day.
Yeah, what was my response? Can you remember?
No, you said, I like that stuff. That's what you said.
That's right.
And I was like, I better revisit that. But my experience at uni was, certainly as soon as we started prac, was I had itchy feet. In fourth year of uni in particular, I had itchy feet saying, I know what you're saying to me is not right, because I've been in the classroom and I know it's almost right, but it's not right.
Yeah.
And I want to let's get through this so I can go and teach, because I know I've got that basis. I've got to start being in the classroom.
Yeah. I mean, it's hard to.
But you know what? I think you really should want students to have that feeling, right?
Yeah. I mean,
it would be
worrying if they didn't want to be in the classroom and they were running away from that. And to be honest, we have those students.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Yeah.
I have to revisit my whole outlook on university.
Do you?
Yeah, I think so. I think I look at it in quite a negative way, but that's sort of the point, was that it must have prepared me in some way. I didn't just go into a classroom and go, all right, I've got it. For 14 weeks or whatever.
Even if you disagree with a lot of what you hear, you do pick some things up.
Oh, yeah.
And you at least develop a habit of reflection. And, you know, if you're still in teaching after X number of years, you must be doing things right.
And think about your conversations with Nick, your friend Nick, who's also been on this podcast. And you know, you two talk about theory and teaching and outcomes. I mean, in that way that it is important to...
No, because at the moment we're bombarded with John Hattie stuff.
Yeah.
And so we know, Nick Isser and I know, that you can't just go into meetings and go boo whenever they mention Hattie. Yeah. You need to do the reading so you can go in and say, what you're actually delivering to us isn't the intention of the work. If you look at... You're talking about data. You want to look at the data... This is what it's telling us, not what you're saying. And that always goes down very badly. And they just push on, usually just push through that stuff. But anyway, I want to get back to the obsession part of it.
Sure. Yeah. I was like, hey, and Matt's talking a lot this podcast. It's great.
I'm not obsessed with education theory.
But this does come back to Wallace, okay? Because I know in 2008, you were teaching, I don't know about a lot of Wallace, but you're certainly...
Just bits.
Bits and pieces, you were teaching a lot. And then he committed suicide. And you had to go to class the next day.
Yeah.
How did you manage that? And I know we're still in contact with some of those kids now.
Yeah.
It's a great class, but they're only year 10. They're 16. They're not, you know, they're not adults. They're still in year 10. How did you deal with that?
To my year 10 class, I don't know which class I read which text to. I read Good Old Neon to... Not Good Old Neon. I read Forever Overhead to one class and Incarnations of Burned Children to another. And I didn't expect anything. It was catharsis for me. It was grieving for me.
Yeah.
It was... I told them what had happened. I don't remember any details from that. I know some of the students very clearly remembering me reading those texts to them. We didn't really do any talking around it. Did bits and pieces. I know I backed off from using stuff after that as well. In any closed text analysis stuff for a while, it was a bit, that was tough. But you know, talking about that, bringing stuff to the classroom before that you're really passionate about and really love, I did not expect anything from those kids except hopes that they would listen and not be too bored. And I suspect a good proportion of them weren't bored. And I know some of them were a bit stunned.
Yeah.
At how and my emotions weren't performed.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And sometimes it's like, no, I need to channel this one for this lesson. Yeah. Right. Or I need to be. Yeah,
you need
right.
to suppress this.
Yeah.
One
whereas I didn't, and I didn't try to.
Hmm.
And I didn't try to, and I probably in both of them was choking up and trying not to cry.
Yeah.
I suspect. But I can't remember.
Hmm. Yeah, and I remember that happening. I remember you telling me about it. I remember kids telling me about it.
Yeah.
And thinking, okay, well, if that ever happens to me, then that's how I'm going to handle it.
Yes.
Was to go in and go, well, this is what's happened, and this is how I'm feeling about it. It might not make any difference to you, but if we're going to be that kind of class that we want or that I want, that you want to be able to come in and say, I'm feeling this way because, and have some kind of understanding. Because that's, I mean, you're trying to build that empathy more than anything else.
And guess what? It's English. And I teach English. And I teach literature.
Yeah.
And I do that because I'm passionate about some of it and obsessive about some of it.
Mm.
And you know what? This is why I'm doing this.
Yeah.
And it's not a bad thing
for
students to see that
you're moved by literature.
Yeah, and that the reason you're doing this thing that a lot of kids can't imagine ever doing, like why would you be a teacher until suddenly those year 10s or those visiting year 11s or you guys think, I was thinking of being a teacher.
Yeah, they do come back and say.
Yeah, but, you know, that's part of it.
Mm.
It's a big part of it.
Yeah. Okay. Now, have you ever taught, Duncan, have you ever taught, I know you've taught Wallace.
Mm-hmm.
At a college level?
Yes.
So year 11 and 12 level?
Yeah, just in year 12.
Classes. Oh, just year 12. Do they take to it? Or do you have to do lots of front-loading lessons? Do you have to...
I always like providing some kind of a frame.
Taking notes because I'm teaching year 12.
And my framing devices tend not to be, this is who this guy is, this is his background, here's mm-hmm. some, you know, socio-cultural contextual information or anything like that.
Yeah.
I tend to come at it from a different angle. So I remember for some reason I started to introduce a sort of a mini unit, about a two-week thing on Wallace, by talking about the nature of social media. And with a particular emphasis on Facebook and the concept of liking things.
Yeah.
And the idea that, it was a little bit like that, the idea of tending to the statue,
mm-hmm.
wanting to have this public version of yourself that at all times must be...
Yeah, it's a presentation.
Yeah, must be liked. Yeah. Like that episode of Black Mirror where, you know, life entirely revolves around social media rankings.
That's right. Yeah.
And how it seems to be quite a 21st century dilemma.
Mm-hmm.
That it's intolerable to be thought of badly by someone, even someone you don't know.
Yeah.
And you're at pains to be liked in a kind of semi-superficial way all of the time.
Yeah.
That was how, for some reason, I chose to introduce Wallace. And then we started to look at a couple of short stories. I think we were focusing on things in brief interviews with hideous men.
Yeah.
Bloody hell, that's such a good way to introduce
yourself.
Yeah, wow. Oh, thank you. Yeah, I tend to come at things from angles that I think are going to be strong connectors.
Yeah.
And I find it boring, just for me as a teacher. Other people might find this a good entree point.
Yeah.
But yeah, I find it boring to go, okay, we're studying Shakespeare. Here's when he was born, and he was in England, and this is what it was like in the 16th century.
Yeah.
Yeah, I always think, so what, if that's how something's being introduced to me.
Yeah. See, I filter it as much as possible down to, like if I'm doing Shakespeare... I just go, look what they used to do to bears.
Yeah.
That's how I start.
Sometimes
go, hey,
just a little piece of trivia
well,
like
let's
that
have
is
a look
good.
At what they do to what do they do? What do they do for entertainment?
Mm.
And let's look at where the Globe Theatre was and what was all alongside it and how.
Yeah.
Globe Theatre, brothel, pub, like.
Yeah, that stuff's a nice sort of.
You've got to, you can't just go in.
Titillating connection.
Because if you do that to them, when they do their presentations, they do the same thing. So and so was born in this year, and you go, why is that important?
Mm.
But anyway, but that's separate from. The next bit I wanted to go over was the reading of Infinite Jest.
Okay.
Because again, Nick gave me this huge tome of a book, and I started reading it, and I was like, all right, this is going to take me some. Thinking, and one thing you do very well, and I don't know,
you're pointing to me.
To Nick, sorry, is not hover. I don't remember you hovering like, because it's slow going. I can't. I think I set myself. I was going to read 20 pages a night. Like, that was my thing, right? I'm going to sit down and read. This is what you can do before you have children.
Yes.
I'm going to devote this time to read 20 pages a night because it's dense and it's small words on big pages. And I read, and that's what I was doing. But Nick never said, how's it coming along? Because for the first 200 pages, I was like, I don't, okay, it's interesting enough. And then there's one scene where they talk about him getting his head, or like committing suicide by putting his head in the microwave. And I just said to him, that was like the best thing I've ever read in my entire life. And my heart was like really struggling to get through it. And then I remember saying to you, what kind of book am I reading where I didn't really get into it to page 240 and I'm still reading it? So that is, it's that kind of book. And it was also the kind of book where at page 900, I went, oh, this isn't going to have like a narrative structure to it. Like 900 pages in, I was like, oh, this isn't a set. This is about addiction and how we cope with that. It's like, what? Like, what? I don't understand. Like, why have I read this far and not understood that? And then just that opening up the rest of it. But I was like 30 or something. How old were you, or how old were you, Duncan?
When I discovered Wallace, I think I was about 22, 23.
Yeah, I guarantee you I wouldn't have coped at that age.
Mm.
21.
Yeah, wow. There's no way I would have coped. I would have just been like, I don't understand.
I think that's why rereads more and more open up to me, though. I said to Matt Booker on the Concavity Show podcast, and he, like, we said to each other, but we grew up with him, which is kind of creepy. Rereadings, and you're like, oh, I've experienced some stuff in the last 5 years, and I never even realised that meant, rereadings were incredible because I was growing up. As well as reading more deeply and just thinking how surface level my first reading was.
That's why I remember you saying to me, I was saying, oh, what about this and what about that? And he was like, wow, you're getting so much more out of it than your first reading. But that's because I was nearly 30.
Mm.
Yeah. And that's really the difference. It's like, I know what this is and I know what that means. But like, as a book as a whole, you put it down and you're like, all right. That's ruined reading for a few months for me now. Like, what am I going to read next that's going to be so intense and gripping?
Mm.
But I just, his style is, and when I do read, especially his novels, I never understood his ability to, he does things with time that stretches.
Mm.
He stretches time like unbelievably. Absolutely. He can just be like meandering along and then all of a sudden you go, I've just read 10 pages. And like literally a second's passed.
Mm.
Like, and I don't know, I've certainly never read anything like that without even knowing it. And I think, I don't know, Virginia Woolf did similar things, stream of consciousness style, where it was just run on things.
Is it you know, lots of people when they read Wallace, and that was a really interesting thing about being online and not speaking to people.
Yeah.
But obsessively hunting for more things to link to and finding when people have discovered his stuff and they're reading it. And so many people would say, it's like the voice in my head. Mm. Like, how can one person be the voice in so many people's head?
Yeah.
Right? But maybe part of it's to do with that, the way we perceive time. Mm. Sometimes, you know, you can get so wrapped up in a thought, or you know you've only been sleeping for a while and you've had this really intense dream, but there's been no time passed.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't know if it's in Forever Overhead, where he talks about how it's impossible to accurately write down your thoughts.
Mm.
What you can think about in 5 seconds would take you a year to write about.
And we even spoke about Good Old Neon before, and so much of Good Old Neon is about that perception and compartmentalizing and time dilation in that and all kind of, like, it's just...
Yeah, it freaks me out. Yeah. It freaked me out reading it, and it still freaks me out if I pick it up. And
I suspect it maybe isn't the case that anyone could pick up a Wallace book and go, my God, this is the voice in my head.
Yeah.
It is people who are of a particular type who would experience that. And it makes me think of that Tracy Austin essay where he tries to imagine what it would be like to be able to tell yourself a cliche like, come on, focus here.
Yes.
And not have an Iago-like voice in your head watching you say that.
Yeah.
And I totally agree that, you know, there must be people who are, you know, very well-paid athletes or whomever it is, who can actually say to themselves, get a grip, and not think beyond
that, exactly.
Sort of mouthing that cliche.
Yeah. Wow. He's, I've lost my train of thought. Anyway, let's just sit in this pause for a bit.
First reading. Okay, I know we had this conversation many years ago, probably when we first met formally, but what was your first reading of Pinterest like?
It was surprise at how entertaining I found the book to be, because I was expecting a Herculean labor.
Yeah.
And I actually read it after 2008. I wish I'd read it beforehand. But yeah, I'd read most of the later stuff, and I read the essays, and in my head there was quite a clear separation between the two. There was an intensity and a seriousness to things like Oblivion or Brief Interviews that I didn't find in the essays, and I was delighted to find that some of the comic energy of the essays was present
in Infinite
Jest. I mean, not like an overdose of it, but enough to get you to keep turning pages. And that never went away. It was there throughout the entire book.
Yeah.
And in some ways, I always felt a little sad that he distrusted or seemed to distrust his own desire to entertain.
Yes.
I think he called it formal stunt pilotry,
picking
up gags and things. And I think, no, those are so important. You can't have just that.
Yeah.
But that's what makes you want to keep reading. At least that's what makes me want to keep reading.
Yeah.
So I suppose my first reading was just surprised that, yes, it is hard going, but there's an incentive on every page to keep that process going.
Yeah. On every page you read something and you're like, I've never seen that expressed that awesomely before.
Yeah, or something that just made me laugh.
Yeah, something that makes you laugh. Like I said, the whole scene with the sons are talking about their father constructing a way to put his head in the microwave is still probably my favorite passage of any book I've ever read.
Yeah.
And I was having heart palpitations because it was a build-up of intensity.
It's
so funny. So darkly funny. And
see, you said a number of times already this evening, it's really dense, right? And I'm picturing the page, and it's like it's actually fine type size and what have you.
Yeah.
But in some ways, it does a bit of a disservice to encouraging people to read it some of it is just so funny.
Mm.
Yeah.
It's so lighthearted.
Anytime I hear the word mold, like it's true. Anytime I see that word, I'm like, oh my God, he's eating it. It's so strange.
I ate this.
That's right. All right. Well, we're going to have to clip on and finish up pretty soon, but I wanted to go again, links all together is Wallace as a teacher.
Mm-hmm.
Because I read, what's the book, Quack This Way?
Mm.
The
interviews with...
It's an interview with him. I can't remember. That's really annoying.
Garner.
Yeah.
His guide.
And he talks about a lot of it to do with writing and how to be a better writer. And it's some of it is really effective for students. And I've printed out two-page... condense a lot of it down, and I give it to students every year. And they don't get it, but they will. But I've said to them, here, take this. Certainly if you keep doing like any kind of English at a tertiary level, university level, just keep this and keep going back to it because things will click in your head. Because it's all about you as a person aren't as interesting as you think you are.
Yeah.
But that's our fault because certainly having that line in Canberra between 7 to 10 and 11 to 12 and what's expected of students, it's really clear because he talks about, and you might as well frame it as, in year 7 to 10, we tell you, just write anything. That's what's important. We care about what you have to say. Oh, if you're writing it, it's interesting. Well done. You wrote this about you. That's great. But then when they get into year 11 and 12, we're like, well, just writing regurgitating your opinions or just saying your opinions isn't interesting to me at all.
Yeah.
And it's really bracing to students
at the start of year 11 to be told, don't just tell me what you think. You've got to do some research. You've got to find out what other people think and tell me what you think about what they think. And that's something they can't do because we set up the system, not in all schools, but in every school I taught, which is, well done, you've written something. And good on you. Like, that's all you wrote about yourself. That's good sharing. Like, that's what it comes down to.
Yeah. There is this popular thing in education about valuing where students are coming from. It sometimes gets called the something backpack that students bring in to class, full of all their own personal baggage. So it goes under different names as well, like cultural habitus is sometimes what it gets called. But it's that idea that everyone has this no one walks in being an empty vessel.
That's right, yeah.
Into the classroom, and you're a bad teacher if you don't investigate what's inside some of those vessels and use that with what you want to teach. But yeah, it can be the case that if that's all you ever do, you're making the opposite mistake. And yes, education isn't just a putting in, but neither is it completely a drawing out. There has to be elements of both. There has to be give and take.
Yeah,
and I think the same is true of culture or literature or art at a bigger level.
Yeah.
Because a lot of people will say, well, what's the value of, I don't know, this 400-year-old Shakespeare play in 2018? I want to see something that's relevant and that speaks to me now. This has nothing to say to me. You think, well, it's not just about what's relevant to you. It's about you discovering something that you didn't know about. Yes. Don't just claw everything back to your own little circle. Look outside of it once in a while.
Yeah. Wow, that's still that. Put that in the poster.
Problem with Facebook. We don't need to talk about this, but that's the problem with Facebook.
Yeah.
The filter bubble.
Yeah,
because you're all filtered.
And all your mates, and you get everything, you get delivered exactly what you're interested in.
Do you find that that makes it harder to be in a class and to connect to the individual interests of 25 to 30 different people if everybody has these kind of unique filter bubbles applied to them?
I don't know, because I've got my own filter bubble. So, I think you do connect with certain students based on things they bring up in class, or a way that, maybe not a way that they think, not a societal attitude, but certainly pop culture references that they might have that you have. You tend to say, oh, okay.
I'm having to change examples, or when I ask for examples in the class, if we talk about music we're listening to or something we're consuming visually, because now you can't assume television or it's Netflix or it's whatever, or they're downloading or whatever, that in the last 5 or 6 years, there's been even more of a diversification.
Absolutely.
You can sometimes have zero overlap, which is awesome. Like, it'd be wonderful to be able to find stuff that was really important to you at that age.
Yeah.
I had a student.
But then no overlap. I guess it's all online.
Yeah.
Which is,
I had a student who was on YouTube watching episodes of All in the Family from like the 70s. They loved the show, and I was like, okay, that's cool. I don't know anything about it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And how did you find that? Like, oh, just going from, oh, I wanted to ask my parents what shows that they watched, and I started watching them, but they weren't so good, and then I found this, and I was like, well, that was pretty good.
That's, yeah.
I was like, okay, cool.
I mean, if I think back to when I was a college-age student, if a teacher made a Simpsons or a Seinfeld reference, everyone in the class would get that reference with maybe one or two exceptions.
Yeah, that's true.
And it's great to have a tool like that in your arsenal.
Yeah.
But I think just 2 years ago, if I'd made a Game of Thrones reference, which is like the biggest cultural thing I can think of at the moment, it would be something that would instantly divide the class.
Yeah.
Where half the class would be into it, the other half of the class would be at pains to point out that they didn't get the reference because they deliberately didn't watch the show, and some students would be mystified, and it's really hard to just drop something that unites everyone.
Well, it's true. I mean,
I deliberately don't watch Game of Thrones.
Just so you can have that.
I just don't like that type of story. Sure. That context. But you know, I do make jokes about it, but I don't watch it because everybody does. Yeah. And I wouldn't like it, but there's that to me.
Sorry. Oh, is this why you don't like the Beatles as well?
No, well, no, I do like the Beatles.
Okay.
I like pushing forward the idea he hates the Beatles.
Yeah, no, I grew up with the Beatles. Dad has most or all of the albums on vinyl. Uh-huh. I listening to them as a child. My kids know songs, but I don't know any of the trivia, any of the fact stuff, and feel totally out of place when I'm with people who do. And it turns out that a number of my close friends, two of them are here, and Tom's in another country, know so much about the Beatles that I just sidle away. And I'll just quietly listen, and I'm always fascinated, but not to the point where I want to read more or whatever. Sure. Yeah. But I get it. I totally get it, and I don't hate them at all. And in fact, I'm back.
Your Honour.
No, that's all right. Yeah. I was just wondering because I know some people make a deliberate choice not to be enthusiastic about the Beatles because it is such an obvious thing to be enthusiastic about.
Yeah. Oh, like I mentioned it in class, I remember most kids were like, you know some of their songs. And I said, but you don't, I said, it's just one of those things. If you started listening to everything, it would blow your mind. And you would go, oh, I know where all this music comes from. Mm. But one of the questions I have written down here is, like, does your obsession, say it's the Beatles or say it's Wallace, if you find someone who has an equal, like, enjoyment of it or an equal knowledge, or does that cut through a lot of the barriers to forming friendships?
Yes.
And or does it put up barriers if people, like you said, if they say, oh, no, I don't like the Beatles, like they're overrated, or, yeah, Wallace, whatever, everyone jumps on that bandwagon after he killed himself, which I've, heard once before.
No, I sometimes find it interesting if somebody really dislikes something that I'm passionately interested in.
Yeah.
I think they're wrong. Yeah. I don't necessarily hold it against them. I'm more interested to understand what it is about your wiring that would make you actively dislike something that to me is so good.
Yeah.
Hmm. It totally cuts down barriers.
Yes.
And being learning to be open about my Wallace obsession. But seriously, Matt, oh, that's interesting. Yeah. Oh, that's and our lovely interview me for the newspaper night at the pub, that this person likes this author and we've read the stuff that this author has had to say and that stuff has changed us or inspired us or made us think different things, and coming to that kind of mutual realization. But Wallace has done it more than say music. Because of crowds and people and stuff makes me feel awkward and always has. Going to a band that I love is awesome, but I never can step out of my head and go, all these people are obsessed as well. I don't do that. I've almost felt it with The Cure the first time I saw them live.
Yeah.
But there's just that obsession for me with Wallace is different to music. And that's kind of why I'm interested to hear more Beatles-y stuff.
But I didn't go and see Paul McCartney.
No,
neither did I.
Yeah. Because I didn't want to be embarrassed.
Exactly. That was the same reason I didn't go.
It's the same reason I didn't. I've never seen Bob Dylan. I had opportunity to see him.
I've seen Dylan a couple of times. No, yeah. I've really enjoyed it.
It's just I don't want the risk. The risk is too high that I don't want to go and go, okay.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like a Paul McCartney concert is a very is something that's very particularly packaged to your average fan, as maybe it needs must be.
Yeah.
And people who come to it from my perspective are always going to be annoyed and frustrated.
But you probably would be, but I know people who went to see him who are equally nutty about the Beatles.
Okay.
And they freaked out because he plays In Spite of All the Danger.
Right.
And that just made them go, oh, my God, that's the greatest thing I've ever heard. Because that was the first song one of the first songs they ever recorded. So there was stuff like that like almost like Easter eggs that he threw in for the hardcore fans as well. But I think you're paying for the experience. You're not paying to hear someone sing well, because he can't sing well anymore.
And that's the embarrassing thing. That's the real reason.
I don't want to have to be convincing myself I'm having a good time at a Paul McCartney concert.
See, I'm worried every time I go see the kid.
I know. I'm fall apart. Of course.
Mm. We had that conversation.
I met you before the Cure concert, and you were very nervous. Anxious about whether we were going to have a good time. Not about whether you were going to have a good time, but whether we were going to have a good time watching the Cure.
It's fun. Yeah, I know it was. I know you did. Yeah,
it's fun. But it's like that. And I'm strangely enough, I'm the same. If I go and see music live, there comes a point where I think, do I look stupid dancing for this song? I can't get out of my own head. Oh. I can for a bit, but I can't for long enough.
Hmm.
Even the Radiohead concert, which freaked me out like about 8 times. We're still kind of the same. I still can't enjoy the whole thing for that. Oh, it's still in my head way too much. But, I don't know. It's like going to see Paul McCartney I would have been just too super anxious like you were with The Cure. That I hope I have a good time, because if I don't, then...
The stakes are too high.
You saw David Bowie, didn't you?
I saw Bowie twice.
Yeah. Really?
Yeah. And that was
extraordinary. We should have started with this. I'm going to wipe all that. Tell me everything about that.
he did...
When was this?
This was 2004, the reality tour, which came to Sydney. And I bought a ticket to see that the second it went on sale.
Yeah.
And unbeknownst to me, my parents had also bought me a ticket. And thankfully, they bought it for the second night in Sydney. So I was able to go to 2 back-to-back concerts.
Mm-hmm.
Thank God I did, because the main thing I remember was the way in the second concert he went back to things that he'd said the previous night, but twisted it in a slight way, but made similar jokes, but there were subtle differences, and the set list was quite different.
Mm.
And how well do you know Hunky Dory? Well, at the second of the Sydney concerts, he played the song Quicksand live for the very first time. Yeah.
This is 2004.
2004. He'd never played Quicksand live before.
Like 71, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a 71 album. Never played that song live. And I was there the night when... I mean, it became a standard thing for the rest of the tour, which was only a couple more months.
Wow, that's amazing.
But
that was the same with The Cure. You were like, they're playing Burn. So I remember getting a text from you. And I was like, no, nothing else. Just... They're playing Burn.
Yeah, well, that tour.
Yeah.
That tour was.
Was The Cure were playing the song they're playing from Burn. From
the Crow soundtrack that they Robert Smith wasn't proud of. An actually awesome song, but also very stereotypically Cure. So I think that's one reason they resisted it, because they were trying to break from that kind of thing. Yeah. And then for that last tour, they started playing it live.
Mm.
And I was also nervous that I paid money, and that's one of my favourite songs. I want to hear them play it live. Yeah. But I had the same experience the first time I saw The Cure.
Yeah.
The first time I saw The Cure was in 2000. That was the first time they toured Australia in a long time. And I saw their Sydney concerts back to back. So they did 2 in Sydney, and I saw both.
Yeah.
And the start, the opening 3 songs, and then Robert Smith asked the crowd, how many of you were here last night? And then so many people cheered, because all the fans are nuts.
Yeah.
And then it was a significantly different set.
Yeah.
And different songs in the multiple encores, and it was... Just, that was just great. And it was, I went to Melbourne after that, and then it was very similar to one of the Sydney ones. And
he didn't count on you.
Yeah, and then I went back to Canberra and met him after the concert.
Oh, wow.
Very briefly, and then I felt embarrassed and terrible. Like a stalker. It was horrible. Absolutely horrible. It's lovely, but he was lovely. That's what I couldn't believe. How many stalkers does he meet after his concerts?
I wonder.
And just says hi and signs.
He just goes, all right, another stalker, fine.
Yeah.
Goes through the same routine with the stalkers.
Yeah.
And then he knows, I get to leave feeling good. They're going to leave feeling terrible for the rest of their lives.
Wondering. Replaying
what they should have said.
Over and over again.
And then maybe they'll meet me again in 10 years' time, and they'll say, hey, I met you 10 years ago, and blow it again. That's exactly what will happen. Just do it all over again. So anyway, I want to get back to Bowie. Yeah. So you saw him in 2004.
Yeah.
And then, so you saw him
Two nights in a row.
All right.
And then I don't know how many more Australian concerts he had to do, but the rest of the tour was scheduled for Europe.
Yeah.
And I think it was only a couple of months after that that he did the show in Germany where he had the heart attack.
Yeah.
And then disappeared. Yeah, it didn't. And I was really, really interested. I was kind of mildly obsessed with a website called Bowie Wonderworld at the time, which seemed to be the best source for news about the little glimpses that we had of Bowie over the next decade. Wow. But about, you know, 8 or 9 years into him doing less and less.
Yeah, wow.
It wasn't that my interest waned. It was more I kind of gave up on new and exciting things from David Bowie.
Yeah.
And then obviously we were all surprised by Where Are We Now being released on his birthday in 2013? There was, you know, the English journalist Catelyn Moran?
She's
a wonderful journalist. Yeah. She's a massive Bowie obsessive, and she wrote a wonderful column about that song coming out, saying that her feeling was like it was waking up to unexpected snow. Wow. That's the perfect way of putting it. That's exactly what it felt like. That level of surprise and excitement.
Yeah, wow.
That suddenly the Bowie was back, and it was this awesome song, and it referenced the past, but it was also very new.
And then
I wasn't as excited, but still really interested when Black Star came out. And then when everyone realized what Black Star was really all about, it was actually another line from another column that resonated a lot in my mind, and it was something like, we were so happy to have him back that we failed to notice he was saying goodbye.
Yeah, exactly right.
Oh,
but he
that blew a hole in me when I read that line.
I think his death blew a hole in me for a while. But he was, I don't know anyone else who was such a popular artist, like in the true sense,
uncompromising,
genuine artist. All kinds of images, all kinds of directions. That phrase, or chameleon like, actually was for him and left in an artistic way.
Yeah.
Like his unbelievable life. And then he's just gone. Mm. Like, here's my album. Bye.
Yeah, disappearing.
I'm going to wait. Breathtaking. Yeah, I'll wait. I'll wait till it's out.
Mm.
Or was it, I don't know, did they release it because they knew he didn't have, he had a matter of days. Like, yes.
I think some of the orchestration around the album and the death was a little bit people interpreting it that way after the
wanting
fact.
It to be.
I think he would have been quite happy to live longer and do more work.
And
I think he was probably hoping to live longer and do more work. And there are interviews with people like Tony Visconti where he said, you know, just a couple of weeks before he died, he said, you know, I've got new songs demoed, I can make one more album. So I think he was very much hoping to keep going for at least a little bit longer.
It was just perfect.
But at least in terms of the way the events played out, it was this extraordinary disappearing act.
Yeah.
And the death seemed to be as artistic as any work he did.
Incredible. Incredible dude. All right, well, we're going to wrap it up because I don't know how long we've been talking for, quite a while.
I don't know. I'm just feeling very sad about that last bit.
Yeah.
Looking at Duncan's tattoo.
Black Star tattoo.
Yeah. Well, hopefully you're all cheery and depressed after that. All your heroes will die eventually.
You know.
Thanks for that.
But it's all right because you'll be dead too.
Yeah, preferably after you die.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was going to leave it on some hopeful thoughts, but you know, hopefully your heroes die after you, and that's it.
I'm closer to the golden dawn, immersed in Crowley's uniform of imagery. I'm living in a silent film, portraying Himmler's sacred realm of dream reality. I'm frightened by the total goal, drawing to the ragged hole, and I ain't got the power anymore. No, I ain't got the power anymore. and the twisted name on Gobble's eyes. Living proof of Churchill's lies, I'm destiny. I'm torn between the light and dark, where others see their target, divine symmetry. Did I kiss the viper's fang, or herald loud the desert man? I'm sinking in the quicksand of my thought, and I ain't got the power anymore. Yourself, don't deceive with belief. Knowledge comes with death's release. I'm not a prophet or a Stone Age man, just a mortal with potential of a I'm living on. I'm tethered to the logic of Homo sapien. Can't take my eyes from the great salvation of bullshit faith. If I don't explain what you want to know, come tell me all about it on the next photo. I'm sinking in the quicksand of my thought, and I ain't got the power anymore. Don't believe in yourself. See with belief, knowledge comes with death's release.
Lifting finale that was. Yep, so as I said earlier, he's Duncan and I talking, just the two of us, about the Beatles.
It was sort of confirmation of how good their quality control was.
Okay. It's not like
Bob Dylan or Brian Wilson,
yeah,
where there are these incredible jewels that never got released.
Yes.
They knew what the good stuff was, yeah, and put that out, and what was left over was actually not that great.
I don't know. I think you're right. I can't. The only ones where I liked some, the anthology versions, maybe not better than the album versions, but some of the Let It Be songs.
Mm. Well, that project is just so fascinating.
It's just mired in.
Yeah, and it's impossible to separate from their personal history.
But that's the only one. But it's not that they had different songs. It was, I like the takes of the songs that appeared on the album. I like the anthology. But I think I listened to the anthology albums before I even had all the Beatles albums.
Really?
Because like you said, I was 17 and there was just one of those things where I got into the Beatles
in a big way. My dad had had albums, and then I bought the White Album myself. Mm. And I got into them, and then, hey, like 4 months later, they're like, oh, Anthology is coming out.
Mm.
So that was just happened to, you know, be perfect for me. So then I listened to all these anthologies before I'd even heard all the album tracks. But still, like you said, it's only found even only the Let It Be songs where I was like, oh, I like the Anthology one.
Yeah, my sister-in-law, Alicia, had a couple of the anthologies and really, really enjoyed them and was really surprised when I told her that the anthologies weren't definitive versions of their songs. They were alternate takes or you know, demos or whatever. Yeah. And I was just so surprised that she didn't realize that. I thought, how closely can you have listened to these? Because a lot of them fall apart.
They fall apart, or, they can't hit the notes.
Exactly.
Yeah, they get the words wrong.
Hello, Duncan. Hello, Siri. Oh. Sorry.
That's all right.
I don't know why that happened. I put it down.
But yeah, I think there's an alternate take of Can't Buy Me Love, which I like.
I like, there are things I like on it, like the version of Annual Bird Can Sing, where they can't stop laughing.
Where they can't stop
laughing. That's really joyful to listen to.
Why? They keep going through it.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's pretty fun to listen to.
That's right.
Yeah.
And I would love to have had... I mean, there are things they didn't put on the anthologies that I would have really liked to have heard.
Yeah, I mean, there's hours and years of stuff that they've got access to that...
Yeah, but something I'm really interested in now are songs that Lennon and McCartney wrote that they didn't record with the Beatles but gave to other artists.
Yeah, yeah.
Some of them are just, like, would have been substandard Beatles songs.
Yeah.
But some of them are amazing.
Yeah.
And there are... you know, Lennon or McCartney demos of those songs from the Beatle era that are fascinating. And one of them, actually, no, two of them appear on the anthologies.
Yeah.
Anthology 3, you've got McCartney doing Come and Get It, which became a Badfinger
song. That's right, yeah.
And Step Inside Love, which was a Cilla Black song. And those are two of my favourite things on the anthologies.
Yeah.
And there's at least a dozen or so of those.
And I think there's a whole lot of George Harrison stuff around that time too that they were like, nope. And you said, all right, I'm just going to put this to the side. And no, George, that's not making the album. Okay, I'll just...
Yeah, I mean, there was an Isha demo of a song called Sour Milk Sea, which he ended up giving to Jackie Lomax.
That's right.
And that would have been a fabulous White Album track.
Yeah, it's a great song.
Mm.
Yeah, there's a whole lot, I mean, especially with George, where they're like, no. Which is weird. Only this week I've put the second... CD, sides 3 and 4 on, because I always listen to the first CD of the double CD over and over and over again. And I put the second CD on, again, mainly just because I was playing Uno with the girls and I just kept annoying them by any time there was a 9, I would just say number 9. And they were like, oh, okay, that's a Beatles song. And I put it on and they were like, what are you talking about? What is this? And I just... Just doing that.
Yeah.
So I put the whole album on and I was like, the balls on that band, that to number one, make a double album, but that second side is so all over the place.
Mm.
And to have like Mother Nature's Son and Sexy Sadie, one after the other, both written about the Maharishi Yogi. Totally different takes on him as a person. Or almost like, here's our take on him when we first met him.
Mm.
This gentle spirit. And then here's our take on him when we left, of just being like, dodgy, to no good.
Yeah, I don't necessarily buy that he did anything really untoward with Marianne Faithfull or his sister.
No.
I think it was just they expected him to be...
Yep.
You know, some demigod, and when it turned out he was actually a human being,
just a guy,
they were bitterly disappointed. It was one of the people that John followed in his life.
You know,
I think he later said something along the lines of he was another substitute father figure who disappointed me like they all do. And I rejected them before they could reject me.
I think that was the other thing too, wasn't it? When they wrote, you know, Dear Prudence as well, it was. Like who they were with and all these famous, semi-famous people all trying to be the most spiritual at the time. Mm. Who can meditate the longest? Who can go the deepest?
That's right.
And be the closest to this guy.
Yeah.
And then I think that's what they, like you said, I think they just went, oh, he's a guy. Well, that sucks.
Yeah.
We've been duped into this. And
yeah, it's funny to think of that being an age where people could be, I don't know, maybe naive isn't the word, but yeah, like optimistic enough to think that they might actually meet someone who's a genuinely enlightened spiritual guru who could show them the answer.
Yeah.
I just can't imagine people having genuine faith in that.
But I think that's, isn't that what, you know, like the, wasn't the hippie movement sort of like they had no cynicism to it at first, like that was the original movement.
Yeah.
Didn't have, hey, this could work. Peace and love could work. Mm. And then people just became like, ugh.
Don't you think too that that's one of the things that makes the White Album particularly interesting, because it's recorded at that time when that optimism sours.
Yeah.
And it makes the music fascinating to listen to because it's darker and more mysterious and interesting. Yeah.
And there's a, like, I just love the range of it. It's from everyone.
Mm.
It's just so great. And it's almost like that crest of the wave where you've got some really hopeful, beautiful songs and then some horrible, cynical, dirty, painful songs.
Mm.
Again, from all of them, it's just, yeah, complete just... They just threw everything up in the air and just said, yep, this will do.
Yeah, maybe I can't separate it from having heard it when I was relatively young.
Yeah.
And when you're at that age, things are much more impressionable.
Hmm.
But it still, to me, is an album that I associate with something scary.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Huh.
Because, you know, I would have been about 10 or 11 when I heard Revolution 9, and it freaked the shit out of me. And I still have that very strong mental association.
Right.
And it was a big vinyl thing that I listened to.
Fantastic.
And so that and a track like Long, Long, Long.
Yeah, Long, Long, Long freaks me out. Still freaks me out. Yeah,
and other ones too, like Cry Baby Cry, I always found quite freaky.
Yeah.
And just I would listen to it and I'd stare at the picture of John on the little on the gatefold, just like looking over his glasses and just knowing that he got assassinated was somehow part of it too.
Right.
But
wow.
But yeah, it used to really freak me out. I found that album was quite macabre.
Yeah.
That seems to be the word for it.
Well, like I was 17, so right at a good sweet spot to listen to macabre music and kind of but the laughter at the end of Long, Long, Long. Oh no, the weird noise. But it's the laughter at the end of Within Without You.
Right.
Which when I listened to it probably at 16, so I probably listened to that and Abbey Road because my dad had them and then the Blue and Red albums. But the laughter at the end of Within Without You, I always felt, being egocentric at that age, was directed at me.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And I think a lot of times I listen to songs like that. And the, what song is it? The Nirvana song, I think it's In Bloom.
Okay.
Where the line is, he's the one who likes all our pretty songs and he likes to sing, blah, blah, blah. And he likes to shoot his gun, but he knows not what it means. I was like, is he singing that about me?
Yeah.
Like, even like at whenever, 15 or 16, when I got into Nirvana as well, it was like, all these songs, because that's all you do. You go, oh, this song's about me. I'm connecting to all these songs. Yeah. But I never really heard people like, oh, I'm connecting to this song and I feel like the artist is mocking me.
Mm.
But that's even in the Beatles, that's what I found, was like, yeah, Within Without You, is he laughing because I'm singing this deep song and you still really don't understand it, do you?
Mm.
That's what I felt like at 15. And so even, like you said, even listening now. Mm. Hey, Nick.
Hello.
Hello. Even listening now, it still freaks me out. Hello.
How's it going? Are you recording?
I am, yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Shit, I've been